open mind. Christina was taken aback.
You know about Jack?
She asked Athena. Everyone knows about you and Jack McKittrick.
Mama?
You better hope she doesn't. But I'm warning you, Christina, you're skating on thin ice.
Shiva.
Steve went to Kathy Stein's house in Perth Amboy, where her family would be sitting Shiva for 7 days. Phil was already there, reciting the prayer for the dead with the other men. They had more than enough for a minion without Steve, and he was glad. He didn't know the Kaddish. He'd never been in a position of having to recite it. Kathy's mother couldn't speak. She looked half dead. Her skin was gray, her eyes rimmed in red, her hair wild. Kathy's younger sister couldn't stop crying. She was surrounded by girlfriends, all of them crying too. A group of boys stood around looking uncomfortable. A nightmare, Steve heard over and over. Yeah, it was a nightmare, all right. But you wake up from a nightmare. And this time, there was no relief because when you woke up, the nightmare was still with you. Steve didn't want to be there. He hoped Phil wouldn't stay long. Phil's mother was in the kitchen, helping with the platters of food that had been sent to the house, all wrapped in golden cellophane and tied with curly ribbon. Sandwiches, baskets of fruits, coffee cakes lined up in a row, like at a bakery. Surprisingly, Steve found himself hungry. He helped himself to a sloppy joe, potato salad, a pickle, then went back for more. He stuffed himself on coffee cake, slices of cantaloupe and pineapple, a couple of chocolate candies. He wandered through the house, stopping to look at a tinted photo of Kathy on the piano, her bright eyes looking directly at him. Happy New Year, Steve. He would kiss that photo if no one were watching. Those sweet, warm lips, cold now, buried in the ground. Except he wasn't sure how much of a body was left to bury. Maybe just that arm with the charm bracelet. Her uncle had identified her by that bracelet, a high school graduation present from her parents. Jeez. He had to shake off these thoughts before he made himself puke. He could already feel the sloppy Joe trying to decide whether to stay down or come back up.
Elizabeth Daily Post. Secretary Patterson to Lyon State. January 24th. UPI. The body of former Secretary of War Robert P. Patterson, who died Tuesday in a plane crash, will lie in state today in the 107th Regiment Armory at 66th Street and Park Avenue in New York. He once served in the regiment. The body will be taken to Washington tomorrow for burial at Arlington Cemetery with full military honors. President Truman and other high government officials will attend funeral services at the National Cathedral there. Mrs. Patterson writes a note. In her Park Avenue apartment, Margaret Patterson, wife of the former Secretary of War, sat at the small French desk in her bedroom and started a note to Laura Barnes, widow of the pilot of the plane, inviting her and her children to spend a day in the country with her family. But she wasn't able to finish. Instead, she put the note in her desk drawer, closed her pen, took off her reading glasses, and sipped the brandy she'd poured for herself. She didn't blame Captain Timothy Barnes for the loss of her husband. She believed he'd done everything he could to get that plane to Newark Airport. She blamed the weather. Her thoughts went to Captain Barnes's young widow and those two little girls who probably wouldn't even remember their father. At least her children were older. They'd have their memories, and so would she. Not that memories were enough. They didn't keep you warm on a cold winter's night. They couldn't hold you when you were frightened or sad. But they were better than nothing. She was a professional wife. She would go on, because that's what he would want. Maybe in the spring she'd send the note, inviting Laura and the girls to spend a day at their farm upstate. Elizabeth Daily Post. The Last 3 Minutes. by Henry Ammerman. January 24th. At 3:41 p.m., the American Airlines Convair had been circling for 10 minutes, waiting for another transport to land at Newark Airport. With the runway now clear, the tower told the pilot he was free to descend to 1,500 feet, instructing him to listen to radar advisories to aid his instrument approach in the rainy, foggy weather. "Roger," replied the Convair. 5.5 miles out, the pilot was informed, "Coming up on glide path, but you're 900 feet to the left of course." At 4.5 miles out, he was, "Nearing the course now, you're 400 feet left." By 4 miles out, "You're on course now. The Elizabeth Courthouse is 1 mile ahead of you." He was coming over the center of town. At 3.5 miles out, the radar controller issued a warning. "You're drifting 900 feet to the right of course, and you're 1/2 mile from the courthouse." 4 or 5 seconds later, the reassuring orange blip disappeared from the radar scope. "American 6780, this is Newark radar. We've lost your target, sir." There was no reply. "American 6780, this is Newark radio. Do you hear?" Again, there was no reply. As the tower anxiously tried to make contact on other frequencies, calls came in from both the Newark Evening News and the Daily Post. A plane had crashed in Elizabeth. Now they understood. There would be no reply. Interviews. Laura Barnes agreed to talk with Henry Ammerman.
"You know, when you marry a pilot, it could happen," she told him. "You know, but you never expect it. He had so much experience. He was so smart, and he always kept his head, never angry or quick-tempered, and on a milk run, of all things. I blame Newark Airport. Something has to be done about that airport before it happens again." She was red-eyed but composed, Henry wrote. He didn't tell her that her husband's wrists had both been broken from trying to hold the controls steady. "Was it true what you wrote in the paper about the last 3 minutes?" Laura asked.
"As far as I can tell."
Days later, Laura had a miscarriage, brought on by stress, the doctor said. The house down the shore was put up for sale. Laura never wanted to see it again. She mourned her lost baby, but not the way she mourned Tim. She would never love anyone the way she loved him. Henry requested a meeting with the pilot's mother. He was told by her remaining son that she was prostrate with grief and could not be reached. Sometimes Henry hated his job. Christina felt numb. She stuck a fork into the underside of her arm to see if the numbness was in her mind or her body. She felt the prongs digging into her skin, but she didn't care. When Henry Ammerman came to interview them at Batten, Christina told him what she'd seen. But unlike some of the other girls, animated and anxious to be heard, jumping up and down, giving the reporter details of how Madame Hoffman, the French teacher, had fainted at the window of her classroom when she saw the plane crash into the brick apartment house, and how they sat her up and fanned her face while the president of the French club ran to see if the school nurse was still in the building, Christina remained subdued. Mr. Durkee proudly told Henry how calm his students had been, how they'd listened to his instructions to duck and cover, scrambling under their desks and staying there until after the last of the explosions. Christina didn't contradict him or any of the other girls.
"You know, Henry," Mr. Durkee said, "just 45 minutes before the crash, 1,000 girls were dismissed from school. Be sure your readers think about that."
"Good point," Henry said, as if he hadn't thought of that himself. Jane Krasner, in New Jersey for her roommate's funeral, talked to Henry about Kathy Stein. Pale, brown-haired, and slender, Miss Krasner was obviously grieving, Henry wrote.
"Kathy was coming home to see a boy she'd met over the holidays. She really liked him. She wanted me to come with her, but it was too expensive to fly, and there wasn't enough time to take the bus. She said her father would pay for my ticket, but I would never go for that. She was so generous and thoughtful. Miss Krasner looked away. I don't think I can go back to that dorm room we shared. I may take the semester off. Maybe I'll transfer to another school. Kathy was my closest friend. Sometimes it's like that. You meet someone and you know you're going to be best friends. You know it right away. Now she's gone. I'll never see her again. She was so beautiful, inside and out. Phonies. When Steve read about Kathy in the paper, when he read she was coming home to see a boy she'd met over the holidays, a boy she really liked, he got into bed and stayed there for 4 days. He thought about dying, but he was afraid to do it himself. His only solace was reading The Catcher in the Rye. Holden was his friend, the one person who could understand what Steve was thinking and the unbearable sadness he was feeling. Finally, his mother came to his room and said, "Get up, Steve." "Why?" "Because we need you to." "That's not a good enough reason." "We know you're sad." "Who's we?" "Your family." Steve snorted. "Stop this, Steve." His mother pulled the covers off him, and just as fast, he pulled them back. "Can't you see what I'm going through?" she cried, burying her face in her hands. She turned away from him, her shoulders shaking. What was this? When she faced him again, she was angry. "Don't do this, Steve, and give me that book." She reached for it, but again he was quicker and shoved the book under his ass where she wouldn't dare try to get it. "I need you to get up, shower, put on your clothes, have breakfast, and go to school. I need you to do that for me." "Who gives a fuck about what she needs?" "Do you understand, Steve?"
"I understand."
Part of him felt bad for her, his pretty little mother. But the other part knew she was a phony, like all the other so-called adults in his life. Not one of them gave a shit about Kathy. She was just another dead person, just one of the tragic 23 on just another crashed plane.
And hardy har, mother dear. It wasn't even a non-sked this time.
He should tell her that. Tell her how he'd traveled back from Boston in a snowstorm in a non-sked, thanks to his father. What would she say then? Maybe he would get up. Maybe he'd get up and go to school and pretend everything was okay, just like the rest of them. He grabbed his copy of Catcher.
"I'm not finished with you, Holden," he whispered to the book. "Or you either, Phoebe."
Fern was his Phoebe, or could be, if she played it right. At school, Phil acted all glad to see him, like nothing much had happened.
"Were you sick? Your mother said you couldn't come to the phone."
"Yeah, sick."
"What kind of sick?"
"Just plain sick."
"You don't sound sick."
"What does sick sound like?"
"Okay, I get it."
"No, you don't," Steve thought. Coffee cake. Mary brought one of Irene's coffee cakes to Mrs. Stein once the Steins returned to their regular routines. Phil at school, Mr. Stein at his office, Mrs. Stein reading in her favorite chair.
"I'm so sorry for your loss," Mary said. "I still can't believe it," Mrs. Stein teared up. "My niece was a wonderful girl, and such promise. Even though we buried her and sat Shiva, none of it feels real."
When Fred barked, Mrs. Stein scooped him up, and her mood lightened.
"I'm so happy to see you, Miri, and Fred, too. Look at this cake," she said, taking it from Miri. "It looks good enough to eat. What do you say?"
Miri nodded.
"And how about a cold glass of milk to go with it?"
Miri nodded again. Elizabeth Daily Post. Editorial.
Barking at the Moon. January 25th. Elizabeth's second air disaster is now 3 days old. Our commercial airline death record has taken first place in the whole world. Show us, if you can, an official act or an official decision made that offers assurance there won't be more slaughter. The governor, who is a lawyer himself, hides behind the opinion of another lawyer. The mayor calls for removal of Newark Airport, bag and baggage, which, he should know, is barking at the moon. The Port Authority sticks to its old reliable routine of patterns and improvements to come, while crash experts give us an answer to everything except why the airport keeps expanding. Let the governor order expansion work at Newark Airport stopped now, today. That would be a gesture of sincerity which would reassure an aroused and grieving people. Public indignation. A few days after the crash, a public indignation meeting was held at City Hall, demanding authorities shut down Newark Airport. More than 1,000 people came, not only from Elizabeth, but other towns along the flight paths. Irene didn't want Ben Sapphire to go. "It could be too much for you, Ben."
"My wife died on one of those planes," Ben said. "I'm not sitting this one out."
"Then I'm coming with you," Irene told him. "Take your pills just in case," Rusty said. But Irene ignored her.
"Come, Rusty," Ben said. "We'll give you a ride."
"Me too," Mary said. She'd made plans to meet Mason there.
"You're not coming," Rusty told her. "You have to be 18.
"You didn't have to be 18 to die," Mary argued. "Penny wasn't even 8.
Henry said,
"I think she can come."
Rusty shrugged.
"I hate this."
"We all do,"
Henry said. Mason was waiting for her with Christina and Jack in front of City Hall. Mary still hadn't met Mason's older brother, but just as Mason started to introduce them, a bum approached Jack, and Mason pulled Mary away, hustling her up the wide steps. It was the first time Mary had set foot inside City Hall, an impressive red-brick, white-columned building. She'd imagined it would be quiet, even serene, but not tonight. The noisy crowd spilled out into the lobby, leaving standing room only at the meeting. Rusty fought her way through the crowd to Mary and told her to keep to the side with Mason, away from the entrance.
"I'll be over there," she said, pointing to a bench where Irene and Ben were already seated.
"I want to keep an eye on Nana. I've got her pills in my pocketbook. If it gets to be too much, go outside."
"If it gets to be too much?" Mary said to Mason, once Rusty was out of earshot. "If it gets to be too much?" As if two crashes weren't already too much.
Mason nodded, but Mary wasn't sure he'd heard a word she'd said. The meeting started with Mayor Kirk saying something about umbrellas, but Mary couldn't hear well enough to understand. Then a representative from the airport promised the new runway, under construction, would keep planes from taking off and landing over Elizabeth. No one believed him. And when the crowd started booing, a police escort rushed him out of the building. After that, tempers escalated quickly. The crowd wanted to blame someone or something. Eleanor slipped in next to Mary. Mary was glad she wasn't the only one here from her class.
"They don't understand it's sabotage, that we're a city under siege."
Eleanor had to cup her hand and speak directly into Mary's ear. It was so noisy.
"Are you going to tell them?"
"I haven't decided.
My uncle says they were accidents, that it was a coincidence.
Sorry, but I don't buy that."
"I know it's hard to believe, but..."
"Your uncle's a reporter, right?"
"Yes. He's sitting up front with the other reporters."
"They don't want us to know the truth. If we did, it would result in chaos."
"My uncle is an honest person."
"I'm just saying our government doesn't want us to know the truth."
Eleanor walked away then, maybe looking for someone else to listen to her theory.
There was wild talk of blocking runways at the airport with a caravan of cars. Steve and Phil and Jack McKittrick were among those who volunteered to participate, sitting in their cars on the runways, preventing planes from taking off or landing. Someone shouted that the pilot was at fault. "The first plane crashed into the riverbed thanks to the pilot's skills. He didn't kill anyone on the ground. But this time..."
Mrs. Barnes's son stood and in a shaky voice said, "My brother was the pilot of the second plane. He was the best pilot in the world. You want to blame someone, blame him." And he pointed to Joseph Fluitt, the investigator from the Civil Aeronautics Board. "He could have closed down the airport after the first crash. He had the power to do that. But he didn't. And now my brother is dead. His little girls are fatherless."
His voice caught.
"How many people have to die before something is done, before more families are torn apart like ours?"
As the crowd chanted, "Close down Newark Airport, or we'll close it for you," Fluitt was rushed out of the hall by a police escort. Two down, Mary thought. A woman stood on a chair, stuck two fingers in her mouth, and let out a whistle so shrill, Mary was sure a taxi in New York could have heard it.
"We have a petition right here," she shouted into a bullhorn. "We urge each and every one of you to sign it. Tomorrow, we're sending it to President Truman and other federal and state officials in vigorous protest, calling for the removal of Newark Airport."
Something bubbled up inside of Mary, a surge so intense she could taste it. She pushed her way through the crowd, calling, "Let me sign that! Let me sign that petition!" Mason was right behind her, hanging on to her jacket. Was he trying to hold her back, or was he trying to protect her?
"Are you 18?" someone asked. "You have to be 18 to sign."
"I'm old enough. Just give me the pen."
Rusty was waving frantically for her to stop. Just try and stop her. Just try and see what would happen. She didn't know what she'd do, but she knew it would be something Henry would have to put in his next story, niece or no niece.
"Give me the pen," she shouted,
until Phil Stein handed one to her. She signed her name, Mary Ammerman, and her age, 15. Mason signed right after her, Mason McKittrick, 17. He wasn't 17 yet, but he would be soon. Mary supposed it didn't really matter. Rusty made her way to Mary's side.
"Enough is enough. Mason, will you walk her home?"
Mason nodded. They didn't say much on the way home. Mary was seething, her gloved hands shoved deep into her coat pockets.
"What?"
Mason asked.
"That," Mary answered, turning back toward City Hall. "And that."
This time, she pointed to the sky.
"It's not what you think," he said.
"I don't know what I think."
When she got home, Mary began to write a story for the school newspaper, but crumpled it up in frustration when she couldn't get it right. She tossed it into the trash and sat looking out her window for what seemed like a long time. Then she retrieved the story, smoothed it out, and shoved it into her desk drawer. Why shouldn't her mind be as messed up as everything else? Elizabeth Daily Post. A Community Pulls Together by Henry Ammerman. January 26th. The mayor calls it the Umbrella of Death. Others are calling it Plane Crash City. No matter what you call it, the citizens of Elizabeth are reeling. An angry crowd of more than 1,000 gathered at City Hall last night, demanding the closing of Newark Airport following the second crash of a plane in 38 days. They did not believe that a new runway under construction at Newark Airport would make a substantial difference to the safety of the passengers on the planes or the residents on the ground. They formed committees, threatened to stage a caravan of cars parked on runways, making it impossible for planes to take off or land, and signed petitions.
Thousands more are expected to sign similar petitions in county churches at Sunday services. The meeting ended with a series of threats. Close Newark Airport, or we'll close it for you. Where will it end? When a man shouted, "Where will it end?" there were no answers to his question. Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, president of Eastern Airlines, said in a press conference called by the Air Transport Association that Newark was a preferred airport to pilots under any weather conditions. He said in most pilots' opinion, it is the best situated, the best equipped, and the safest airport in the entire country. 10 pilots representing 5 airlines confirmed the statement. They said their personal choice in bad weather would always be Newark. But such talk had little effect on the people of Elizabeth. Indignation, which had run in angry undercurrents through the city, boiled to the surface. Now the community is pulling together. The Red Cross is asking for blood donations for those injured on the ground and for food and clothing for the displaced. Volunteers are needed to provide temporary housing. It's time to take action, says Richard F. Green, Red Cross disaster director. This could have happened to any of us. Chapter 16. Daisy. Christina told Daisy about Polina, the young mother who worked in the kitchen at Janet Memorial, who'd lost everything when the plane smashed into her apartment house on Williamson Street. "She has a little boy," Christina said, showing her a photo of a tow-headed 3-year-old. "My family can't take them in. We already have my sister, her husband, and their little boy sleeping in the attic room, and my grandparents in my sister's old bedroom." That was more than Christina had ever said about her family. Daisy lived in a small house in Linden with her older sister, Evelyn. They had a spare room as big as a closet. Daisy knew if she asked, Evelyn would say no. So she didn't ask. She brought Polina and Stosh home that night. Evelyn didn't make a scene in front of Polina. She waited until Daisy had made up the bed in the spare room before giving Daisy hell. "You have no right. This is my house as much as yours. How dare you?" Daisy listened to her sister's whispered outrage, said she understood, then poured herself a drink, went to her room, closed the door, lit up a Camel, and picked up a book. Evelyn came around after a few days, thanks to Stosh, who'd taken a liking to her. He chose to sit in her lap after dinner, asking her to read him a story. She began to bring him little surprises when she came home from work, a toy car, then a truck, and finally a bus. He said he wanted to live with her forever. Polina was still learning to speak English, but Daisy had no trouble understanding her. The young mother was so grateful to have a roof over her head and a warm, safe place to stay with Stosh. She couldn't do enough to help. "Please, Miss Daisy, I cook you supper tonight." She shopped for food, paid for it out of her meager salary, and scrubbed Daisy's kitchen and bathroom without ever being asked. On Sundays, Polina got herself up like a glamour puss. Then she and Stosh went off to church, taking the bus into Elizabeth from Linden. Daisy admired Polina's optimism. She'd lost everyone close to her in the war, but she was committed to giving Stosh the chance she'd never had. Daisy drove Polina and Stosh to Elizabeth every morning. Polina looked much younger without makeup. So lovely, with clear skin, plump arms, and a nice bosom. Polina had to be in the kitchen at Janet Memorial at 6. She dropped Stosh off at the babysitter's house first. It was an hour earlier than Daisy usually came to work, but she didn't mind. That extra hour gave her the time to catch up on billing and correspondence. If she finished in time, she enjoyed relaxing in the waiting room, reading magazines, sipping a coffee from Three Brothers, trying to think of a nice young man to introduce to Polina. There was someone who worked in the lab down the hall. Miri went through her closet, pulling out shoes that didn't fit, skirt she hadn't worn since sixth grade, her old lime-green dress coat. Rusty said the rule for grown-ups was, if you haven't worn it in 5 years, you'll probably never wear it again. For kids, it was 2 years. Irene didn't agree.
When you've been through 2 world wars and the Depression, you don't think that way.
Irene saved everything. But even she was putting together a box of clothing.
I wish I'd saved Estelle's things, Ben said.
It's not like you sold them, Irene said. You donated them to a good cause.
Mary went to Natalie's house to help her clean out her closet. Natalie grabbed armloads of clothes still on their hangers and threw them onto her bed.
Just give it all away, she told Corinne when she came into the room, including my cashmere sweaters, Natalie said, scooping them out of her dresser drawer.
But Corinne hung all the good things back in Natalie's closet.
You're overreacting, Nat. I don't care about any of it, Natalie said, flopping down on her bed.
Mary was about to volunteer to take the cashmere sweaters herself, but Corinne saved her.
We'll give away anything you haven't worn in 2 years.
So Corinne knew about Rusty's 2-year rule. 2 years meant since Mary and Natalie had been best friends. It felt like way longer than 2 years to Mary. She could hardly remember life without Natalie. That she was able to covet Natalie's cashmere sweaters at a time like this, when the people who'd lost everything in the crash had nothing, made her feel ashamed. She, after all, had Charlotte Whitten's hand-me-down dresses. Wasn't that enough? What was wrong with her? Why was she thinking such selfish thoughts? At school, they had a drive for pots and pans, canned goods, toys, and books. The Red Cross was collecting boxes from all over town. Ben Sapphire was picking up and delivering. Irene was cooking and baking by day and knitting by night. After work, Rusty volunteered at the Red Cross house, putting together boxes of household goods and clothing to match each family's needs. Some nights, Rusty would stay out late, serving coffee and sandwiches to the volunteers working at the morgue. It was much harder to identify the victims this time. This time, they were all burned beyond recognition. Dental records were often the only way to find out who they were, except for the pilot. He was the first to be identified by what was left of the stripes on his uniform. The busier they kept, the better they felt. At least they were doing something positive.
Elizabeth Daily Post. What Went Wrong? Will They Ever Know? By Henry Ammerman. January 28th. The initial findings in the probe of the January 22nd crash of an American Airlines Convair point to a sharp, almost vertical drop of the plane. When it was noted that this must have resulted from a radical equipment breakdown, Chief CAB Investigator Joseph O. Fluitt said he was not yet ready to draw any conclusions. But another official, speaking off the record, speculated that the pilot might have tried to pull the plane upward in a desperate effort to redirect the crash away from Batten High School, leading to a stall, which caused it to plummet directly to Earth. He noted that the pilot, Timothy Barnes, had grown up in Elizabeth and had graduated from Hamilton Junior High and Thomas Jefferson High School. He lived only a few blocks from Batten. Captain Barnes surely realized the possible implications of crashing into that particular building on a school day.
Chapter 17. Mary. Life goes on, became Irene's mantra. If Mary heard that expression one more time, she was sure she would explode, just like the planes. If life goes on, then why shouldn't she go with Frecky Strasser to the paper mill playhouse?
Out of the question, Irene said.
Because, Mary prompted.
Because you can't trust the Monskys.
You think Frecky is going to kidnap me and send me to another planet in a flying saucer?
You'll discuss it with your mother.
Ben Sapphire wants to take you to Miami Beach, she told Irene. Who's to say he's not going to kidnap you and take you on a flying saucer?
I should be so lucky.
You'd like to get on a flying saucer with Ben Sapphire?
What's all this about flying saucers?
It was true that Ben Sapphire wanted to take Irene on a trip to Miami Beach. He reminded them his wife was heading there when her plane went down in the Elizabeth River, as if they needed reminding. Miri still saw that plane in her sleep. She could feel the heat. She'd wake up drenched with sweat and have to change her pajamas. Once she was awake, she found it hard to get back to sleep. To calm her nerves, to take her mind off Plane Crash City, she'd look into her kaleidoscope, telling herself, "You're getting sleepy. You're getting very sleepy." If all else failed, there were stories in the paper that gave her other things to think about. Action! Camera! One of many candid camera shots taken during the play, Goodbye My Fancy, presented by the Vale Dean School Dramatic Club, assisted by the Pingree Players. You could tell the pretty blonde in the photo in the paper, wearing the strapless dress with a full skirt, was the lead. She was probably the most popular girl at Vale Dean. Miri imagined herself at Vale Dean, wearing a blue jumper and white blouse, the school uniform. All the girls at Vale Dean were rich. They dated the boys at Pingree, who came from the same kinds of families. Some of the boys crossed themselves before basketball games. Miri had been to a game once with Suzanne, who had a cousin at Pingree. All of them went off to fancy colleges. Then they married each other and lived in single-family houses with big backyards, had chubby babies, and drank themselves to death. Miri knew the part about drinking themselves to death wasn't necessarily true. She was just trying it out to make their lives seem less perfect. Irene. Ben called Irene his safety net.
Without you, I'm lost. Your warmth calms me.
She could think of worse things for a man to say to her. Rusty once accused her of rescuing people the way some people rescue stray animals, the way Mason had rescued Fred. Miri had told her about that, about how he'd found Fred starving and wet in a snowstorm when he was just a puppy. No collar, no tags. Mason had nursed him back to health. Miri knew Irene would respond to that story, but she still wouldn't let the dog into her side of the house. Ben Sapphire, on the other hand, wasn't a dog. He was a grown man who owned apartment buildings in Jersey City and Elizabeth, and he considered himself Mishpoka, one of the family, with her blessing. She told Rusty she was thinking of taking him up on his offer to go to Miami Beach. They would travel by train. Maybe for a week or two, although Ben would like to stay longer. From the look on Rusty's face, you'd think she'd just announced that a man had landed on the moon. "He has 2 bedrooms," Irene said, "one for him and one for me, and my own half bath, just a few blocks from the ocean." Miri, who wasn't included in this discussion, but was listening anyway, kept her mouth shut. "I know his family," Irene continued. "He knows mine. What could go wrong?" Now Rusty looked at her as if she'd lost her mind. "You think I don't know he could have any woman he wants, with his real estate and his new Packard? Am I somebody who ever wanted another husband? I have everything I need right here. My family, good friends, plenty to do. But a little adventure, what could be bad?"
"You know what could be bad," Rusty said.
"You're worried I'll get pregnant?" When Irene laughed, Miri laughed with her. Rusty, stone-faced, didn't.
"I'm worried about your feelings, your heart."
"I have pills for my heart."
"Not if it gets broken."
"Darling, thank you for caring so much."
Rusty shook her head and walked out of the room. Miri stayed and gave Irene a hug.
Daisy.
Longy had the last appointment of the day.
You know, Doc, you look like hell. No offense meant.
And it was true. Dr. O had dark circles under his eyes and was so pooped at the end of office hours, he sometimes took a snooze on the couch before heading home. Daisy was worried and prayed it wasn't his heart. She'd been there when he'd lost his two brothers to back-to-back heart attacks while still in their 40s.
You need a vacation,
Longy said.
Come to Vegas with me. We'll shoot craps, eat the best steaks you ever tasted. I'll show you around town. Sounds good, Abe, but I can't get away now. Doc, sometimes when you think you can't, that's the time you have to.
Longy could be very persuasive.
You like Betty Hutton? Is the Pope Catholic?
Longy laughed.
She's playing in Vegas next week. I wish I could, Abe.
Before he left the office, Longy took Daisy aside.
Help me out on this, Daisy.
I'll try, Mr. Zwillman.
I'm worried about him.
Me too.
So Daisy cleared the following Thursday, Friday, and Monday without further discussion. Corinne called Daisy the next morning.
Whose idea is this trip to Vegas?
She didn't wait for an answer.
Longy's, am I right?
Corinne. Daisy took a deep breath. He needs to get away. He's exhausted. It's beginning to affect him at the office.
He could go away with me.
That would be wonderful, and I'd be glad to stay with the children.
The children,
Corinne said, as if she'd just remembered. We can't both be gone at the same time. Not now.
It's just for a long weekend,
Daisy reminded her.
Yes, a long weekend, but with Longy.
Daisy laughed.
No denying that.
Corinne sighed.
All right.
Daisy said,
if you need anything, I'll be around.
Thank you, Daisy.
On Wednesday, after office hours, Longy picked up Dr. O in a limo heading for LaGuardia.
We'll catch some winter sun if we're lucky,
Longy called to Daisy.
Catch some for me, too.
Daisy waved goodbye. Dr. O waved back. Miri. Henry and Leah were planning their June wedding. They'd once talked about renting a big house down the shore, and everyone would come and stay for the weekend. But they'd changed their minds. The wedding would be smaller now, in a garden at the Hotel Lorraine in Bradley Beach.
How could they be planning a wedding? Miri wondered. Because life goes on?
Maybe this was true, and maybe it wasn't. Life might go on, but it didn't go on in the same way. It would never be the same for the Fosters. It would never be the same for the Steins. It might never be the same for Natalie. She didn't know who Natalie was anymore. She wasn't even sure about herself. Who was this girl who looked back at her from the mirror? If she'd once thought being in love could fix anything, she didn't anymore. It couldn't bring back Penny or make Betsy better. She begged Rusty to let her go to the paper mill playhouse with Frecky.
What's the worst that could happen?
Rusty didn't give her an answer. When she turned and walked out of the room without another word, Miri knew she'd won. At 8:30 Saturday morning, Mr. Roman of Mr. Roman's House of Beauty on Elmora Avenue circled Miri, who sat in his chair. She was about to splurge on an Elizabeth Taylor cut, shampoo, and set. Rusty, a big believer in long hair, would kill her if she knew. When Rusty caught her leaving the house so early, Miri had her excuse ready.
I'm going to the library, she'd said.
Be careful, Rusty told her. Did that mean don't let any planes crash into you? Did it mean don't let the aliens turn you into a zombie? Or did it mean look both ways before you cross the street and don't talk to strangers? Mr. Roman's House of Beauty was already busy, with two women under the dryers, two more getting shampooed, and a second haircutter at work. The manicurist was polishing the nails of a lady Miri thought she recognized from the junior department at Levy Brothers. Mr. Roman held up sections of Miri's hair.
"Nice," he said. "Some natural wave, but you'll have to set the new cut in pin curls at night. Are you sure about this?"
He was making Miri nervous. Was he trying to talk her out of cutting her hair?
"Because once I start," he said, "there's no turning back."
"But how do you think it will look?"
Miri asked, hoping for reassurance. He kissed the tips of his fingers.
"Fabuloso."
Was that an Italian word? If so, did it mean what it sounded like? Either way, the decision was made. Mr. Roman picked up his scissors, and snip, 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 the process began. Was she making a big mistake, or would she leave the shop looking like Elizabeth Taylor in A Place in the Sun? She stuffed two pieces of Fleer's double bubble into her mouth, then blew bubbles so big they burst against her cheeks, until Mr. Roman told her he found such a habit distracting and not worthy of a lovely young lady. Under the dryer, she read Silver Screen and Photoplay. Ava Gardner was on the cover of both. 2 hours later, she paid with her babysitting money, trying not to think about the Fosters. Would they approve of her spending the money they'd paid her for watching Penny and Betsy on a haircut, while Betsy was being treated for severe burns, and Mr. and Mrs. Foster were keeping a vigil at her bedside? Was she a terrible person for thinking of how she looked when they still didn't know if Betsy would live or die? She caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror as she left the beauty parlor, and at first wasn't sure who it was. She looked older, but nothing like Elizabeth Taylor. She shouldn't have let Mr. Roman use hairspray. She hated hairspray. She walked home without her hat, letting the cold winter wind whip her hair around. Before going inside, she ran her fingers through it and checked herself in the mirror of her Volupte compact, a birthday present from Leah. That was better. At home, she'd have to hurry to get ready. Frecky was picking her up at 11:30. She prayed Rusty wouldn't hear her come in, anything to avoid an argument today. It was laundry day, vacuuming day. Miri was responsible for her room, which she'd cleaned last night. But just as she opened the front door, Rusty was coming up from the basement with the laundry basket. Miri braced for the worst.
"Cute,"
Rusty said, barely looking at her, which threw Miri for a loop. This was so unlike the reaction she'd expected, it worried her. When she was almost ready, in her cashmere sweater and pencil skirt, Rusty brought her the strand of pearls her parents had given her on her 16th birthday. Pearls, even though Rusty's father had lost his business and was working behind the counter for next to nothing at his friend's bakery. Miri knew about the pearls, but until now, Rusty had never offered to let Miri wear them, and Miri had never asked. Today, Miri thought, Rusty was trying to send Frecky a message. "See how well I've managed without any of you? See the daughter I raised without your help, in her cashmere sweater and expensive pearls?" "Be yourself," Rusty said, giving her an extra long hug. Miri understood. "Make me proud. This woman with the yellow Cadillac is nothing. She's no better than us. Remember that." Inside, the yellow Cadillac smelled of leather, like new shoes. Miri had never been in a Cadillac. Even the Osners didn't drive a Cadillac. Not that Corinne didn't want one, but Dr. O had a patient with an Oldsmobile dealership who gave him a good deal, so that was that. On the drive to Milburn, Frecky chatted about the play they were going to see, an operetta, The Desert Song. She sang a few bars to Miri. "Blue heaven and you and I." Her voice was low and smoky.
on key.
I love musicals, she told Miri.
Frecky might be a regular aunt taking her niece out for the day. Miri pretended that's what they were. She worried at first about what she would talk about with Frecky, this aunt she didn't know she had until recently. This aunt whose brother was Mike Monsky, the same Mike Monsky who was her father. Her father? It struck her as such a strange idea. She wanted to laugh. And maybe she did, because Frecky looked over at her, and Miri pretended the sound was a hiccup. Frecky didn't say anything about the latest plane crash. It felt good not to talk about it. But it made Miri wonder if people in other towns thought of it at all. The restaurant across the parking lot from the playhouse had once been a real carriage house. You could still see the stable doors. Inside, it was fancy, like Charleston Gardens at B. Altman and Company, where she'd gone last year with Corinne and Natalie. The same white tablecloths and a small flower in a glass vase on each table, lace at the windows. A slice of lemon floated in her water glass. At first, Miri thought it was a mistake, but then she noticed lemon slices floating in everyone's water glass. She saw just one man in the restaurant, seated at a table with an elderly woman who looked like she could be his mother. At every other table were mothers and daughters, aunts and nieces, grandmothers and grandchildren. A few of the grandchildren were small boys, fidgeting in their best clothes. All the little girls wore party dresses. At a large table in the corner, a group of teenage girls were celebrating someone's birthday. A waitress dressed in black with a white apron handed Miri a menu. Cream chicken on toast points with buttered peas. Pork chop with creamed mushroom sauce. Chopped steak with creamy mushroom sauce. Tuna casserole with creamed corn. Everything was creamy. Ugh, she hated creamy sauces. At the very bottom was a children's menu. Spaghetti with butter. Grilled cheese. Hot dog. It would be embarrassing to order off the children's menu, but better than ordering creamed something or other and not eating a bite. Frecky leaned over and whispered, "The menu is so goyish, but they'll make you grilled cheese if you'd like." The waitress gave Miri a look when she ordered grilled cheese, but Frecky came to her rescue. "She can have whatever she wants," Frecky told the waitress. "Just charge me for a second tuna casserole and bring her the grilled cheese." Miri might like this woman, if only she were allowed to. Frecky smoked an old gold while they were waiting for their food, her diamond ring sparkling in the sunlight, her nails polished dark red to match the color of her lipstick. "Nasty habit," Frecky said, as she flicked an ash into the glass ashtray on the table. "Take it from me. Don't start." Miri had already decided she wouldn't, even though it looked so sophisticated. All the movie stars smoked. Rusty limited herself to two a day, one after lunch and one after dinner. Henry smoked. Leah didn't. Corinne didn't, but Dr. O and Daisy did. Irene didn't. Ben Sapphire smoked a cigar after dinner. Then there was Mason and his Luckies. Everyone left the restaurant at about the same time and headed across the way to the Paper Mill Playhouse, an old mill turned into a theater, where Frecky snapped a picture of Miri, her coat unbuttoned to show off her birthday sweater and Rusty's pearls. Before they were shown to their seats, Frecky bought Miri a souvenir program. At one point during the performance, Frecky looked over at her and smiled. They came out humming the Desert Song, the most popular song in the operetta. "I've always wanted a daughter," Frecky said. "I have two sons, but they wouldn't be caught dead at an operetta."
"Maybe they'll get married and you'll have daughters-in-law who'll go with you."
"That'd be nice, though daughters-in-law don't always like their husbands' mothers."
"But if you're nice to them..." Miri thought of Irene and Leah, who liked each other.
"Yes, maybe," Frecky said. "I hope so, But that's still years away. You'll have to meet the boys. They're 17 and 19. It's good for a girl to have boy cousins.
Cousins? Miri thought. I have boy cousins.
After the show, they stopped for ice cream at Grunning's on the hill. There was a line waiting for tables. But Frecky said,
"Oh, look!"
And she pointed to a table. Miri followed her gaze to a table with a man seated facing them. He waved to Frecky. Was this Frecky's husband, Dr. J.J. Strasser, who was such a good provider? They lived in South Orange, and who had bought Frecky a yellow Cadillac and a big diamond ring? She followed Frecky to the table. Suddenly, like a cat with its whiskers stiff, she knew this was not Dr. J.J. Strasser. Dr. J.J. Strasser would be older, she thought. He wouldn't look so much like Frecky, with thick hair and a toothy smile. He stood and helped Miri off with her coat, draping it over the back of her chair. When they were all seated, with their napkins on their laps, Frecky said, "Miri, this is my brother." Before Frecky could get out the rest, before she could say his name, Miri said, "I know who you are. You're Mike Monsky." He said,
"Yes."
Frecky added, "Your father."
"He's not my father," Miri thought. "He doesn't even know me."
Her body was telling her to flee. "Excuse me," she said, pushing back her chair and running, coming this close to colliding with a waitress delivering ice cream sundaes to some happy family. Another waitress pointed her in the direction of the ladies' room. Inside were little girls, teenage girls, their mothers, their grandmothers. She splashed her face with water at the sink. Someone asked, "Are you all right, dear? Do you need help?" She waved her away. No, she didn't need help. And no, she wasn't all right. But she was going to pretend she was. She was not going to throw up in a stall in the ladies' room of Grunning's on the Hill, with all these fancy mothers and daughters watching and listening. She breathed through her nose the way Natalie did when she felt nauseous, which was often. That was better. She applied pixie pink lipstick. She patted down her hair, then fluffed it back up. She hated her new haircut. She'd already decided to grow it out, and Mason hadn't even seen it. The door to the ladies' room opened.
"Hi," Frecky said to her. "Everything okay?"
"You planned this," Miri said. "You tricked me." Two women blotting their lipstick glanced over at them. Frecky gave them a weak smile. Miri knew she could make a big scene and embarrass Frecky. Maybe she would.
"I planned the meeting here, yes."
Miri raised her voice. "The whole day was a lie." What did she care? There was nobody here who knew her or her family, but there might be somebody who knew the great Frecky Strasser or her doctor husband. Frecky shepherded her away from the sinks.
"I wish you wouldn't look at it that way."
"How should I look at it?"
"As an opportunity. I thought you should meet your father and that he should meet you."
That stopped Miri for a moment. Then she turned and marched out of the ladies' room, shoulders back, head high, as if she were the queen of posture, and back to the table. Back to Mike Monsky, her so-called father. She took her seat at the table. The waitress asked what she'd like.
"A dish of plain vanilla, please. One scoop."
"Hot fudge, nuts, whipped cream, maraschino cherry."
The waitress held her pencil at the ready.
"Plain, please."
"Okay, just a single scoop of vanilla in a dish."
"Isn't that what I said the first time you asked?" Miri thought.
But instead of screaming, throwing a temper tantrum, yelling at the waitress, who wore red-framed cat's-eye glasses turned up at the tops with tiny rhinestones in the corners, Miri said,
"Yes, thank you."
Saying it like that, with such authority, made her feel calm, in charge of her feelings. Mike Monsky said,
"This is awkward for both of us."
She knew he was looking at her, but she refused to meet his gaze.
Maybe for you, she said, but it's not awkward.